Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the news and stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill sits down with Patricia Levesque, CEO of the Foundation for Excellence in Education. Doug and Patricia hop in their DeLorean to imagine their utopian public education world in the year 2039. For both, it is centered on equal opportunity. Expanding and creating new educational savings accounts is at the top of Doug and Patricia's wish list for an educational utopia. They specifically discuss equalizing access to the shadow school system, giving lower-income students access to things like summer programs, camps, and travel that students from higher-income families have always had. This interview took place by phone on Friday, August 9th, 2019. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the interview.
So I want to welcome Patricia Levesque to our podcast today. Patricia is one of the state's and nation's leading thinkers about ed reform. At Step Up, we've been celebrating 20-year anniversary of the A-plus plan, which was the plan that the legislature passed at Governor Bush's urging in 1999. And we've had a lot of interesting articles on the blog talking about all the great things that have happened in the last 20 years. But we thought it'd be fun to sort of look ahead. We've looked back for 20 years, but we thought it might be fun to look ahead. And Patricia is one, like I said, one of the country's most interesting thinkers. And so I thought it'd be fun to brainstorm with Patricia about what public education might look like 20 years in the future. So welcome, Patricia. Thank you for giving us some time today.
Thank you, Doug.
So let's assume it's 20 years from now. It's 2039. And all of your hopes and dreams have been realized, at least for public education. So let's just start off with an overview of generally, you know, what's happening? What's the system look like? You know, what are teachers doing? What are kids doing? Overall, what's the big picture? What's the system look like in 20 plus years?
Well, wow, what an important question, because I think if you don't know where you want to go, it's really hard to move policy to get there. And so, you know, my ideal public education system would be one where every single child is getting what they need to be successful. Students are receiving the therapy or the reading supports, the social and emotional supports, the challenging curriculum and pathways to acceleration if they need it, the teachers that can accommodate their specific learning styles. I want every child to be engaged and excited and supported and safe. And, you know, kind of fundamental to this is, you know, it's the system where every family has the ability to pick the school and the services that best fit their child. And like, that's a high level, what I think would be an ideal public education system.
You know, we talk a lot about customization, and that word resonated with me when you were talking. That's really what you're talking about, right? Is a system that's flexible enough to sort of move out of the one-size-fits-all system that we've been struggling with for 150 years to a system that really is capable of customization. Is that the right characterization?
Yes, customization. I like to use the word personalization as well, because it is personal.
Right.
You know, that the future opportunities for each child, I mean, that's something that's really personal. And how often do we hear about kids where, you know, people didn't think that was going to be the kid that was going to achieve X, but they do it, right? They do it in spite of having a system that wasn't helping them nurture those skills and strengths that they need to be successful. Well, that I don't want that to be the exception.
Right.
I want that to be the rule.
So I'm an old guy, so I've been in this work, you know, 40 plus years. And I know, I remember in the mid-70s when I first got into education, we talked a lot about customization, and we were never able to execute. We talked a lot about personalized learning. So it's always been a dream, but actually making it real has always been a challenge. So I want to drill down a little bit. I think a lot of people think technology really is a game changer in terms of allowing us to really provide that individualized, personalized instruction for every child. Can you talk a little bit about how you see technology beginning to help us move to where you want us to go?
technology is so rapidly evolving that what I envision with technology is that it's giving teachers tools so that they can do so many things for the kids, right, and with the children. So technology that helps a teacher bring rich curriculum straight into the classroom. When you think about how rapidly things occur, how even on the drive into school that morning, there is news about something that has happened, and having technology and a system that lets a teacher bring that lesson that's ripped from the headlines, you know, right into the classroom that day to apply to the math lesson or to whatever the civics or the science lesson or whatever that the teacher already had planned. Technology can help teachers do that. Technology can help teachers personalize or customize learning for kids, meaning, you know, it can be a tool to help teachers give some students more time because there are certain math concepts or skills that they just need more time and more practice before it clicks, before they move on. But yet there's other kids in the classroom who need to be challenged and need to not be held back. And technology and personalized math-based tools can help teachers meet every child where they are and give them exactly what they need in order to move forward. I think technology can also serve as a tool to help teachers ease their workload so that they have more time to focus on the kids and what's important and what they need to do to intervene or challenge certain students in the classroom. So technology for me solves those problems, as well as it's an incredible tool to provide access. In 2039, as well as in 2019, we should be able to bring any course and any high quality instructor to any kid.
One of the challenges that we hear about is sort of a digital divide, and technology actually exacerbating inequalities as opposed to helping create greater equality. You're talking very articulately about how technology can help teachers personalize the instruction, but how do we avoid greater inequalities, and how does this system in the future do a better job of creating greater equality of opportunity for every child?
Yeah, that's a great question. A couple of things, and one is, so before I get into technology and like the hardware, right, the tool and the Wi-Fi and the broadband and all of that, I want to shift just a bit to computer science instruction.
Okay.
And that is, you know, almost everything that we encounter, we as adults or even that our kids encounter, is impacted by the internet, by machine learning, by algorithms, by big data analysis. And we do not, in Florida, and we don't in most states across the country, we do not do a good job of making sure that our kids, starting in elementary school, right, have computer science instruction so that they can understand the things like the computer science principles that are foundational to the way the world works now. And so one step that every state can take to kind of not only bridge the opportunity or access kind of divide, but also just foundationally prepare our kids for the future, is to require and offer computer science instruction starting at an early age, because almost like, you know, the three R's of old, reading, write, and arithmetic, computer science is going to impact everything that they do or touch, all their jobs, you know, how they purchase things, how they travel, how they move around. And it just, computer science needs to be elevated and needs to be one of those things that become part of the core curriculum in schools. That's one thing. But going back to the technology digital divide, I would say the good news is more and more families, even, you know, low-income families, have access to smartphones and things like that. Florida has been doing a better job of making sure broadband, you know, using the federal E-rate funds and making sure that schools are wired. The gap that exists that troubles me is what happens when that child goes home, right? So some kids go home and there's more smart and devices at home than the number of people in the house, and other kids go home and there's one cell phone with only cellular service and they don't have Wi-Fi. You know, some states have been pretty big and bold in trying to address this through, you know, at least at the school level, having one-to-one kind of technology policies and ones where the kids get to take that, you know, piece of technology home. Other school districts or states have been thinking about that, you know, Wi-Fi access. I don't have a perfect solution, except that I will tell you I had a conversation with a superintendent who no longer works in Florida, but I had a conversation with one of the biggest wireless carriers, and said, what would it cost if a school district, when they went to do a bid for their Wi-Fi services for their school system, if they added in as part of their bid that the coverage area would also include low-income students' home? And the response from the wireless provider was there really wouldn't be that much additional cost to the contract. And I communicated that to that superintendent. Again, fortunately, they're no longer a superintendent in the state of Florida. But I do think creative things like that need to be done, and they can be done at the local level. I suppose they could also be required at the state level. But I think, you know, that type of contracting for those services is best done at the local level. But those are things that absolutely need to be dealt with, and the state should think about what are our investments and how do we support districts in expanding that capability.
I noticed when we first started, you talked about kids having access to schools that best meet their needs, but also out-of-school services. You know, Florida is got the largest educational savings account in the country with the Gardner Scholarship Program. And I suspect soon we'll be moving other programs into educational savings accounts. Talk a little bit about how an educational savings account might help us address equal opportunity in terms of out-of-school learning as a way to give low-income kids access to the kind of things that more upper-class kids already have access to.
Sure. And Doug, I think your question is broader than the way I'm going to answer it, but I'm just going to use a very specific example, and that's summer enrichment.
Sure.
You know, upper income, upper middle income, you know, wealthier families make sure that the summer for their kids is full of enrichment, whether it's academic camps, you know, going to a space camp, a science camp, a STEM camp, or again, remember, getting back to kids' strengths and gifts and passions, or, you know, a fine arts camp, or, you know, a musical camp, or traveling, right? Traveling to Europe to actually see places where, you know, going to England, right? Seeing things in England and understanding the interplay between where the settlers came from way, way, way back when, and the tension between the two countries back then, like seeing it and experiencing it. Upper income kids get access to that type of enrichment in the off hours. Low income and even middle class kids, often summers are, you know, because those things cost money, are not filled with the types of enrichment activities that you would hope that all kids have. And so, you know, my ideal is at some point in the future that a way to combat this opportunity, this enrichment gap, is that, you know, public and or public-private funds can be put into summer enrichment accounts, where every family, low-income, middle-class families, has funding that they get to use over the summer to provide enrichment opportunities for their kids. Whether those enrichment opportunities are things like, we need to spend more time working on reading and math and things where the child needs help so that they get caught up or they don't slide, where it's just this rich exposure to all kinds of activities and experiences that go beyond academics sometimes and give kids that base of understanding of the world that will help them be successful. That to me is how an education scholarship or spending account could be used to bridge divides and really enhance the overall opportunities for kids to be successful in the future.
I want to talk a little bit about accountability. I know that's something that you and I have worked on for decades. In the new world, it seems like, you know, we've got to begin to rethink sort of how we regulate these systems. I remember my younger son, and this was, you know, 10 years ago, when he was in high school, at one point he was in four different schools at the same time. You know, mm-hmm. he was in a dual enrollment program. He was in a charter school. He was in a virtual program, and he was taking some learning experiences at his neighborhood zone school. And so it was hard to say who was responsible for his progress because he was all over the place. And increasingly, that's going to be normative, right? After school programs, you have summer programs like you just talked about. You have kids in virtual programs. You have kids, you know, taking classes from multiple different providers. How does that look in terms of what an accountability, what a regulatory accountability system looks like? How we balance regulation and choice? How does that begin to redefine how we understand and how we operationalize what we traditionally thought about as accountability?
Sure. In education speak, you kind of said it, accountability typically means testing or school grading and the consequences and interventions and rewards and all the things that come, you know, to be attached to that testing and school accountability system. But I would offer up that accountability also means giving parents information and power that helps them ensure their child is getting the education they need to be successful. And that is, that power comes in the form of choice, right? The more that you give parents the ability to have power or leverage in the process so that they can curate, right? They can customize, they can put together the type of education experiences and programs and services and environments that they want for their child to be successful, that is the ultimate form of accountability, because parents are the ones that have the responsibility for their child's success, but they're the number one people who are invested in how their child is going to succeed. When you look at national polling, when you look at these things and when you ask parents in focus groups or just in general, when you're talking to them, how do they know that their child is doing well? How do they know that a school is a good, high quality school? Typically, the top two answers are, I can tell from my child, right? Whether he's engaged, whether he's excited about learning, whether he's, you know, excited about going every single day. They get a lot of information from their own child, and the other is from the child's teacher. From how that teacher interacts with the parent, from the information that that teacher gives back to the parent, teachers get information that they need to determine if that school is, you know, working for that child. Now, that is something that the state and government will never be able to replace. Those are things that parents hold in high value, and no matter where they go to school, the schooling model, they're going to rely on that information. The reason why Florida and many other states have important, and I would argue they're very important, regulatory accountability models, right? The testing and school grading and the consequences and interventions. The reason we have those things is because we have compulsory education laws where we say, parents, send your child to school or you will go to jail. And unless you can afford the school that you believe, you know, best fits your child's needs, we tell you where to send your child to school. So we tell you you have to send them, we tell you where to send them. And what we know in many instances is those schools are not
environments where the majority of kids are actually learning and being successful. And so then the state needs to put in, I think it's a moral obligation to put in those accountability and regulatory structures to get the adults in the system to make sure kids are reading, kids are doing math, kids are graduating on time. But there's no, if we were going to start from scratch, we wouldn't build the system that we have. If we were going to start from scratch, which is, I think, where we need to look to move the system to, we would have one where we funded every child based on the needs of that child. You're a student with special needs, you need more support. You're an English learning student, you're going to need some more support. You're a low-income student, you're going to need some more support. So we fund based on the needs of the child.
Well, that was beautifully said. I don't know a lot of people who fully appreciate the fact that I think Governor Bush's primary motivation in 1999 and the legislature's motivation was to make sure that the children who historically been underserved were better served. And a lot of the regulation that was put in was really designed to make sure, like you said, that would push resources to people that historically don't have power. As you know, every education decision is a political decision. And the most valuable asset we have in school districts is teaching quality. And I can guarantee you that the doctors and the lawyers and the mayors and the newspaper publishers, their kids get the very best teaching. And so I don't know that everybody fully appreciates how progressive Governor Bush and the legislature were in 1999 about saying, okay, given these people have no power, what can we do at the state level to sort of redirect resources? But like you said, once the families are empowered themselves, there's far less need for the state to come in and to be a heavy hand, because the families now have the power they need to make good decisions. And that's information and money, because we know that money is power. And when we give families that money, as you said, it makes a big difference. So that was very well said. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other insights you have about things we should be thinking about, you know, moving forward? Like you said, all roads are good roads if you don't know where you're going. So I think it's important to get out in terms of where we're going.
Well, you know, I could go on and on a lot of issues. I think one that is in front of us is workforce education and career and technical education. And so that's one that we've been engaged on in the past, and that the Foundation for Florida's Future and Excel in Ed will engage on more in the future. And, you know, there's a lot that needs to be done in career and technical education. We've got to make sure that the courses that we're actually offering to kids are aligned with real labor market needs and opportunities. And those opportunities need to be mid-skill, mid-wage job or higher. We need to stop preparing kids for minimum wage jobs in these CTE programs. And there are so many opportunities there to add coursework in cybersecurity and advanced manufacturing and areas where there is, you know, I'll use a statistic that is not exactly correct because I'm using it off the top of my head, but in the state of Florida in 2016-17, there were like 5,000 jobs available in this that required CompTIA Security Plus certification, and those jobs average $82,000 a year. And yet in our secondary education systems, I want to say we prepared 18 kids in that area, right? That's just one example of there are incredible pathways to prosperity and opportunity for kids that we are not investing in the state. But in the converse, we're offering a lot of courses that lead to minimum wage jobs, maybe in fields where there's not even job growth that's projected. And so we've got to really do a better job of career and technical education and how we improve those offerings, how we get rid of dead end pathways, and how we align those pathways to college as well, right? So that it's not an either or, you're going to college or you're going into a career. It's really, in the future, there's going to be on and off ramps where kids have gone to college will need to go back and get more technical education. And kids with technical education will need those credits to transfer into college so that they can build in the future. So that's really one area that I think is important. And the other is I've been thinking a lot about teachers in the state and teachers in general. I think there are a couple of things that, you know, we're still working on and thinking through, but, you know, in general, I think one thing is we don't value our teachers enough. And when I say value, I do mean pay. We don't pay teachers in our country or in the state of Florida enough. And that is, that impacts who thinks about going into the teaching profession, that impacts their teacher's ability to stay in the profession. And so in general, we need to raise teacher pay in the state. Now, in addition to that, I think there's a lot more that goes into why people go into the teaching profession than pay. And so a lot of those other concepts, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, we have educational scholarship accounts for kids. Why don't we have professional spending accounts for teachers, right? Why don't we put more money into the hands of teachers so that they can decide what type of training they need to improve in their own classroom, right? Some teachers who are, you know, recognizing that every year they have a child on the autism spectrum in their classroom, they may want to spend their summer actually taking training that helps them work with kids with special needs, or more specifically kids on the autism spectrum, right? Or, but most teachers, if they wanted to do that, they'd have to pay for that out of pocket because most professional development is very centralized at the district office. And so I've been playing or thinking about this concept of how do we not only put money into teachers' hands to raise their pay, but how do we put money in teachers' hands so that they can find and curate the professional development that they need in order to be successful? And then how do we recognize that? There are these things called micro-credentials that where teachers can demonstrate that they have certain skills that we know those skills help them have better outcomes with kids, whether those skills are things like teachers, you know how to create a growth mindset in the classroom, teachers know how to put together, you know, hands-on learning experiences within the classroom. You know, teachers know how to do, you know, differentiated instruction. There are several things that where there are micro certifications that demonstrate that a parent know or that a teacher knows how to do something. Well, we should think about having a system where we reward teachers when they can demonstrate they have these skills. You know, that's very different than the current model of, you know, every 5 years, a teacher has to do 120 in-service points to show that they, you know, are qualified to be recertified. And most of that training is district-driven, may not be of interest to the teacher, and doesn't actually demonstrate anything more than the teacher sat in a professional development class. Rather than how do we help teachers demonstrate that they know certain skills and have the ability to communicate things that will be make them more effective as a teacher. Those are some things that I've been thinking about, and there's plenty more to talk about, but I realize time is short.
Well, those are all wonderful thoughts, and I told our listeners that you were one of the country's great thinkers, and that clearly that's the case. So I want to tell you how much I appreciate your time, and hopefully we can do this again because I know you have a lot more great ideas to share. So with that, I'll say thank you, and hopefully we'll do this again, Patricia. Thanks.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you for everything that you and Step Up for Students does for kids in the state of Florida.
All right, thanks.